Well, what does it mean when the preacher gets up in the pulpit area? This must be doing something different. Well, we were talking about a series of lessons about the relationship of the Christian and the government or the state under which he lives. And I was somewhat ambiguous about continuing that series with the college students gone. And then I had this request come out of the blue. Would I answer a question from 1 Corinthians chapter 7? So if you want to be turning to that passage tonight, we will take our lesson from 1 Corinthians chapter 7. And like Barry, I did not intend all my verses to come from 1 Corinthians 7. Well, no, I did. That's the difference anyway. Well, we're glad to have everyone with us tonight. And the lesson tonight, I hope, will be something that is relevant and practical, of course, to each of us. Even if some of us are not married, we still need to understand what God's laws about marriage are. And we certainly are not all going to find ourselves in the various situations that are discussed in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, but there is a principle here that is applicable to all of us as God's people. And that's the fundamental thing we need to get out of this chapter, if nothing else. We've been singing some songs tonight about how we will sing of the mercies of the Lord. Well, do we really look to the Lord as being the source, the standard of authority in all that we do? Or we might consider, as the deer pants for the water, so we long and we yearn for God. Or we want God to be our vision and our wisdom. All of the songs that we have sung, in one way or another, look to God as being what it's all about. And yet the problem is that when we get into certain areas of our life, and marriage is perhaps one of the most common of these, we find it very easy to be conflicted between what we want and what God says. And it becomes very easy then to begin rationalizing and saying, well, ultimately God wants me to be happy. And I can't be happy in this relationship. And so we start looking at passages that talk about marriage or divorce or remarriage and reading them now through filtered lenses, really reading what we want to hear rather than what God may actually be saying about these things. Well, and obviously this is going to be a passage that had been a subject of great controversy, and I don't expect I would convince everyone about how I approach this passage, but I can't do anything but guide you and to explain to you at least how I understand this passage, and as in all that I attempt to do as I teach, to try to provide what is the real foundation and context within which to understand the passage. I mean, anybody can read a passage and just say, well, this is what it means to me. But why should it mean that? There has to be something we can hold on to and build the foundation of our interpretation on. And if our foundation is weak, then our interpretation is going to be weak. And so the lesson tonight is going to be more of an instructional kind of a study of 1 Corinthians chapter 7 as opposed to a motivational lesson. You know, don't get a divorce. Well, there are places for that kind of motivational preaching, but here we're going to try to just understand what the text says for us this evening. Now, I've entitled the lesson, Whittling on God's End of the Stick, or it's a return to that little theme we dealt with not too long ago. But it occurred to me in considering this passage that we could add to that another category of how we try to whittle on God's end of things. And I look at it as supreme interpretations. Now, this is not a political commentary on the Supreme Court, but there certainly are a number of people that want the Supreme Court to be a body of people that impose their will and their interpretation on the text of the Constitution. And that's what we can wind up doing with the Word of God. We treat the Bible as a so-called living document, which means that we can massage it and change it to apply it to our peculiar circumstances today. And maybe this wouldn't have worked for people 500 years ago, but this is what works for us now, that kind of thing. And of course, what we are doing is, we're keeping the text, but not really, because we're substituting an interpretation of the text that really turns the text upside down on its head, and we're just explaining away the text. And of course, when we do that, we are presuming to speak for God again and putting ourselves in the place of God. Well, the passage in question particularly is this expression found in verse 15 that a A believer is not under bondage or not bound in a particular circumstance that has to do with divorce. And what exactly does that mean? And so we'll get around to looking at that. But first we have to begin by looking at what the overall outline of this chapter is. And we could characterize it that the chapter deals with marriage and issues related to that. That is pretty much obvious, and everybody would agree to that. But I would say that the chapter basically falls into two parts, which you can recognize when you look in verse 1. Paul says, "Now concerning the things about which you wrote." And then in verse 25, he repeats that, "Now concerning." And here's another issue that comes up. Chapter 8 begins the same way, "Now concerning this issue about food that's been offered to idols." And in chapter 12 and verse 1, "Now concerning these spiritual gifts." And it appears that what has happened is the Corinthians have written a letter to Paul. And it's not like I thought when I was a little kid growing up that, the Corinthians just thought Paul was the greatest thing since sliced bread. And we've got a Bible question. Well, who are we going to ask? Let's ask Paul. Let's send him a letter with all of the questions that have come up in Bible class recently and see if we can get his apostolic answer to these things. And it becomes obvious as we study the letter more carefully that, in fact, the Corinthians were saying, "Well, Paul, who do you think you are? You tell us. We can't go to pagan temples and worship, and we can't go visit prostitutes, and we can't do this. Who are you to say that?" And they're taking exception to much of the teaching that Paul had given them in his previous visits with them and in the letter, apparently, that he had written to them before that he refers to back in chapter 5. And so they've written a letter, a somewhat challenging letter, and in this they bring up a number of topics. And two of these, at least, have to do with this issue of marriage. And he addresses two of these in this particular chapter. And so from chapter 1 through verse 24, or chapter 7, verse 1 through 24, we could see that as kind of the first half of the chapter. And the beginning in verse 25, another topic that he turns to. One indication that Paul is clearly changing topics, even though they're still related to marriage, he uses this term virgin in the chapter, but up through the first 24 verses, that word doesn't occur at all. And then it occurs six times from verse 25 to the end of the book, or end of the chapter. And then likewise, this idea of getting married, that expression is only used twice in the first half of the book. It's used eight times in the latter half of the chapter. So that suggests, again, there's really two, although related, but there's still two distinct issues that he's addressing here. And then as we look even more closely, we can actually separate verses 17 through 24 out, because this is where, in the heart of his answer in dealing with this overall issues about marriage, he establishes a basic principle, which is, you should stay as you are. Now, we don't have time tonight to look at verses 17 through 24 in detail, but it is obvious that Paul is not saying this is an absolute requirement, that however you are, you've got to stay that way, which would mean if you're not married, don't ever get married. Or if you're married, then don't ever get a divorce. If you're a slave, don't ever try to get your freedom. And that's one example that he gives in this particular section where he indicates, yeah, it's okay to get your freedom if you're able to do that. The point that Paul is really getting at, instead of setting up an absolute rule that you've got to stay exactly as you are, he's addressing a misunderstanding that the Corinthians have about spirituality. That somehow their spirituality is bound up in certain circumstances or details of their life. Like whether you're a slave or whether you're a free man, does that have anything to do with what kind of Christian you can be? Well, it can affect your life practically, how much free time you might have to serve the Lord or something like that, the way in which you serve the Lord. But you can still be a faithful Christian whether you're a slave or not a slave. And the same thing is true whether you're married or whether you're single. And you can think of any number of other circumstances that, yeah, the Bible gives you instructions about how to conduct yourself in this circumstance or that circumstance, but the circumstance itself has no bearing on whether you're a Christian or what caliber of a Christian you can be. And that's what Paul's trying to address here. Don't feel compelled that I've got to change my status, that I have to change who I am because somehow what I am now is not acceptable to God. Now clearly we're not talking about moral issues here. We're talking about matters of one's life, like how much money you have or what kind of job you have, things that really have no moral bearing directly, those things are irrelevant to who you are as a Christian. And so instead of being consumed with the need to change this status, be content and just stay as you are. If God called you to be a Christian and you were a slave, He's happy for you to remain a slave and to still serve Him as a Christian. That fact is not going to affect your Christianity at all. And if He called you while a free man, that's not going to change anything. The call of Christ is separate and apart from these various statuses that we find ourselves in. And so that's the basic principle, and I wish we had more time to develop that, because that's really what underlies the entire chapter. And it's that principle that's going to be applied in verses 1 through 16 to those who have previously been married. So if you're married, what would the basic principle be? Stay married. And if you're not married, if you've never been married, what's the principle? Well, don't feel like you have to get married or be consumed again with, be preoccupied with that in a spiritual sense, because it has no bearing. And so that's going to set the tone for what's going to happen then in this chapter. So now further looking at the context of what's happening in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, we've already indicated Paul's answering the questions that they've asked him. He says that quite explicitly at the beginning of chapter 7, and then presumably when he says now concerning, and that does a variety of topics after this, that all of those are answers that he's given in response to questions or challenges that they've raised. And as you look at those different answers that he gives, each of those sections also appears to have references to things that they were saying. The clearest example of this is from chapter 8, where Paul is clearly quoting from something that they have said to him, presumably in the letter that they have written. And so there are a number of these Corinthian slogans that we might be able to identify throughout 1 Corinthians. And Paul is obviously answering their question and responding to some of the things that they had said in their letter. Well, in regard to this particular issue, it appears that what has happened is that the Corinthians have decided that abstaining from sexual relationships is something that is good and helpful for your spirituality, that you'll be a more holy person if you refrain from this. Now, this shouldn't be surprising to us, because we know all kinds of religious groups that get into this mentality, and I've known even some Christians that adopted this mentality, and they, husbands and wives, quit having relations with one another, and then it wasn't too long before they were committing adultery against one another, and that's not surprising. Because the Lord tells us that that is a misplaced, you know, a gross misunderstanding of what spirituality is. And it's a gross misunderstanding of what marriage and the marriage relationship is. And if one is putting their confidence and their spirituality in things like that, rather than where it truly belongs, it's not surprising you wind up with the kind of decadence and immorality that you do. And so, basically, here's how I would see the chapter unfolding. That when Paul says in verse 1, it is good for a man not to touch a woman, that again is one of their slogans that they had said. That they had written a letter to Paul and said, hey, don't you agree it's good for a man not to touch a woman? And like with all of the slogans that we find in the book, there is a sense in which Paul would agree with that. But in every case, he so qualifies it that he really disagrees with it. He certainly disagrees with what they mean by it. And so in the same way, whether this statement is original with Paul, he would mean something quite different from it than what the Corinthians would. But I think it's more likely he's saying, yeah, you say it's good for a man not to touch a woman. Now, there's a sense in which I'd agree with that. But the way you're using that expression, I strongly disagree. And we'll discuss that as we go on, of course. And so, then verses 2 through 7, here is the basic problem. What are two married Christians in the congregation at Corinth supposed to do? If you're more holy, if you abstain from relations, well, you just need to quit having relations with one another. And so Paul's going to address that issue. But what if that's too difficult? Well, get a divorce. And that'll take some of the pressure and temptation away. And certainly, if you're married to an unbeliever, a pagan, that really is contaminating your holiness. You know, if you could imagine having relations with another Christian is somehow perverting your holiness, then certainly if you're married to an unbeliever, get out of that relationship. And then, of course, the preoccupation with the latter half of chapter 7 is don't make the mistake to begin with. You know, if you're fortunate enough not to have gotten married yet, whew, thank goodness you've escaped. You can really be spiritual and holy because you're not getting yourself chained down to this spirituality-sucking relationship. So don't make the mistake of getting caught up in it. Well, that's not to deny that some relationships are like that, but that's not basically the point. All right, so again, Paul is responding to these issues in regard to those who have previously been married in verses 2 through 16. And as I indicated before, in every case, Paul is rejecting their particular viewpoint. And he gives, in each case, an exception. And I put the word exception in quotation marks because they're not real exceptions at all. And so the first situation we might look at in verses 2 through 7 are these people that are married. Presumably here he's describing two Christians that are married to one another, but the principle would apply to any that are married. And he says, basically, you people that are married to each other, you need to be having relations with one another. Now there's an exception he gives for prayer, for a time. But as you see, that's not a real exception at all. You know, it's so temporary and it's by mutual agreement and so on that it's not the kind of thing they're talking about. So there is a kind of concession there, but the principle is that these people that are married to each other ought to be involved in those relations. Well, the second situation that he addresses in verses 10 and 11 are the case of those that are married, and clearly here he's talking about two Christians that are married to each other, two believers, don't get a divorce. That's the rule. Stay as you are, and for married people, don't get a divorce is how you stay as you are. And yet he gives an exception again. If you are to divorce your spouse, what do? Well, remain single or be reconciled to your previous spouse. But again, that's not really much an exception at all. The rule still is don't get a divorce. And then the third case, in verses 12 through 16, here is an unbeliever who's married to a believer. And what is the believer to do in that situation, in a what we might call a mixed marriage? Well, the rule is still don't get a divorce. And the exception that is given here is that if the unbeliever leaves, if they divorce you, well, let them, you know. But again, that's not an exception at all. You're completely powerless to do anything about it anyway. You can't fret about it. You can't do anything about it, so don't worry about it. And so, again, Paul's addressing these different situations. Now, you'll notice we've actually skipped over verses 8 and 9. So we went from 7 to 10. Verses 8 and 9 are kind of a subset of this first case here, and we'll talk about that when we get to it. But that's the perspective from which I'm going to approach this question. But one thing I would say before we look at these verses in some detail is that one thing that you notice that's different in the way that Paul approaches these situations for the married versus those that have never married, when Paul applies the principle stay as you are to those that are married, he's very combative. He's very, very direct and emphatic. You don't get a divorce. That's the rule. That's the way things are supposed to be. And if you're married to each other, be married to each other. But when it comes to answering the question about those that have never married, it's more, well, this is his preference. This is what I would suggest to somebody. But in the final analysis, you don't sin if you do get married, and you don't sin if you don't get married. So that's a free choice that the Christian has, whether he wants to get married or not. And so that combativeness, that emphasis that Paul has in the early part of the chapter is gone by the time we get to the latter part of the chapter. Well, let's go ahead and look at the text that is before us. Now concerning the things about which you wrote, it is good for a man not to sexually touch a woman. But because of occurrences of immorality, each husband is to have relations with his own wife. Each wife is to have relations with her own husband. The husband must repay what he owes to his wife, and likewise also the wife to her husband. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. And likewise also the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Now, just to make a couple of observations here, I have translated these expressions a little bit more pointedly to draw attention to certain aspects in the text. The quotation in verse 1, it's good for a man not to touch a woman. Now, a lot of people read that like it'd be good not to get married. But that's not what that expression means. In this context, to touch a woman is to engage in a sexual relationship with her. Like in Genesis chapter 20 and verse 6, where God says he didn't allow Pharaoh to touch Sarah. Well, what that means is not to engage in that relationship with her. And then in verse 2, he says, because of immoralities. And again, a lot of people have read that to mean that there might be potential problem. If people don't get married, they might be tempted and engage in fornication and so on. That's not what Paul's talking about. In fact, there are ongoing instances of immorality, sexual immorality, fornication going on. And it's because of this, you know, cockeyed scheme of thinking that we're going to be more holy people if we refrain from this relationship. And you could say, well, how in the world is this happening? Because just prior to this, in chapter 6, Paul was addressing this whole problem that some of the Corinthians were going off to prostitutes. And Paul had to address that problem. You can't do that. Your body is not your own. You were bought with a price. Glorify God with your body. And in that context, it meant you refrain from improper relationships you've got no business being involved in. But as we come into chapter 7, glorifying God with your body in regard to these people is precisely the opposite. You need to engage in this relationship. And that's what Paul emphasizes three times in three different ways here. If you don't do this, if married people do not engage in this relationship, what's going to happen is you're going to have all kinds of immorality going on. It's no wonder that some of these Corinthians were going off to prostitutes to satisfy their carnal desires because they felt like perhaps they had no choice. So here's what Paul says about that. Each husband is to have his own wife. And again, a lot of people read that to mean, you know, you should have a wife. Well, no, to have here, again, is another expression for engaging in a sexual relationship. Husbands are engaged in sexual relationships with their wives. Wives are engaged in sexual relationships with their husband. And you notice the mutuality of it here, which is one of those interesting places in the Bible that disproves this kind of feminist notion. The Bible's just a bunch of patriarchal garbage. Paul is very careful to emphasize there's a mutual relationship here. And it goes both ways. It's not that the sexual relationship is the husband's prerogative and it's the wife's obligation. It is seen as both, on both sides of this relationship. And so each husband has have relations with his wife. Each wife's have relations with her husband. Well, to put it another way, the husband is to repay what he owes the wife. To render his due benevolence, I think as the King James Version says. Here again, it's spoken of as an obligation, what is owed the other person. The sexual relationship's not viewed as something I am owed. It's rather viewed as something that is owed to the partner in the relationship. The wife does not have authority over her own body. The husband does. And likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. And so three different ways Paul has tried to put it very directly. You got a husband and a wife. What's the kind of relationship they ought to have together? That's it. And so, to summarize it in verse 5, stop depriving one another. That's what's been going on. Stop it. Okay? So stop depriving one another, except, and here comes the exception clause, except by agreement for a time, so you may devote yourselves to prayer and come together again so that Satan will not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. But I say this by way of concession, not of command. Yet I wish all men were even as I myself am. However, each man has his own gift from God, one in this manner and another in that. Well, what are we to make of these verses? Well, already as I've emphasized to you, I think the heart of Paul's argument is verses 2 through 5, or even 2 through 6, we might say. But kind of the traditional view, or what I call here the common view, and obviously my view is the correct view. There's no other way around that. I think it's the correct view. I wouldn't be up here, right? But this common view that certainly I've heard many brethren take this particular approach sees the real emphasis and point in verse 1 and verse 7. And everything verses 2 through 6 is just kind of a digression that gets off the main point. And Paul deals with some issues, but the real point he's making is found in verse 1 and verse 7. And I think it's just the opposite. I think the real emphasis is found particularly in verses 2 through 5. And so here are some issues we might think about. Where does this statement, "It's good for a man not to touch a woman," come from? Who said that? What's the point of verse 2? What's the force of the command in verse 5, "Stop depriving one another"? What's the antecedent of this in verse 6, "This I say"? Well, what's he referring back to? What did he say that he's reminding us of? And then finally, what is the point of verse 7? Well, in the common view, I guess you might say, you might explain it something like this. Paul says it's good not to marry. But if that's too hard, then get married in order to have a sexual relationship. But marriage, however, is not a command. It's a concession to human weakness. Celibacy is the ideal, and Paul wishes everybody could be just like him. And in that approach, then, what you see is verse 1, "It's good for a man not to touch a woman." See, that's the preferred ideal, celibacy. And Paul is the one who says that. Then in verse 2, when he says, because of immoralities, you know, because of the human weakness of those who aren't able to live up to the ideal of celibacy, well, God allows for marriage. He'll concede that, allow that for other people. And so verse 5 simply means, well, if you are married, you know, don't deprive one another of what's going on. The "this" in verse 6 refers back to marriage. So again, what I'm saying to you is, it's good not to get married. It's good to be celibate. That's the preference. That's the ideal. Now, yeah, if you're too weak, then go ahead and get married. Now, I say that by way of concession, you know, but really, you ought to really strive for the ideal of being celibate. And so again, verse 7 returns us to that basic point. Oh, I just wish everybody could be like me, you know. And that puts the emphasis again on verse 1 and verse 7. Be like Paul, be celibate, remain single, and so on. Well, again, I think the correct view is that the Corinthians are the ones who had made the slogan, "It's good for a man not to touch a woman, it's good not to have a sexual relationship with a woman." And Paul would agree with that to a certain extent, as we've already said. But what they mean by it is, we ought to quit having relations with one another. And the point of verse 2, again, Paul saying that no married people are to be involved in having this relationship together. They've already, in fact, been engaging in this kind of a silliness, and Paul says you need to stop doing that. And it's this temporary abstinence for prayer that he's making the concession about when he says, you know, you got to stop depriving one another. Now, if you mutually agree to it, set aside a short period of prayer, that's fine. But I just say that by way of concession. You know, that's certainly not a requirement and a command that he's making. But the concession, again, is the exception that he's given in verse 5. And then verse 7, when Paul says, "I wish other brethren could be like me," it really becomes more of a wistful idea, I guess you might say, as I put it here. You know, I could see where many would look at Paul and say, "Well, look at you, Paul. You're not married." And cite him kind of as an example or a standard to follow. And you could see how if Paul, certainly in this chapter, tells us, especially in the latter half of the chapter, that, yeah, he does recommend people don't get married because of the present distress and some other things. But he gives that recommendation on a far different basis than what they are taking it. And so Paul has to be careful here not to set himself up where they're going to draw the wrong conclusion from what he's saying to them. And so, yeah, he has a preference that people be celibate and single like he is. But if you're married, you can't be celibate. And if you're married, you can't be single. That is, seek a divorce. And so once you're married, this preference of being celibate and single would no longer apply. But the important thing about verse 7 is that Paul makes it very clear. God has given each one a gift. And no gift is better than another gift. They're all gifts from God. It's just like he's going to say in chapter 12, the body's composed of many different members, but they don't all do the same thing. Well, we're not elevating speaking in tongues over prophecy or healings or anything else. And in the same way, I don't think Paul is elevating celibacy over the other gift. He's simply saying, hey, if everybody could be like me, that'd be great. But the fact of the matter is, not everybody lives that way, and that's fine. But that's just a side note. The real point is, this is God's expectation for people that are married, that you be together and stop depriving one another of those who've already fallen into that. Well, we're obviously not going to get finished tonight, but let's try to get down through verse 9, and we'll stop there for the evening and return to this, I guess, I don't know, next week I'll just preach while you're singing or something. I don't know. Verses 8 and 9 are a little bit of an aside again, as Paul has brought up this issue in verse 7, that if everybody could remain as he is. So I say to the widowers and to the widows, it's good for them if they remain even as I remain. But since they're not exercising self-control, they must marry, for it is better to marry than to burn. Well, most of your versions are going to say, to the unmarried and the widows, it'd be good for them to remain as I remain. Well, what's going on here? Well, as we've already suggested, beginning in verse 8, and then again in verse 10, and then verse 12, different categories of people are being brought up. Here it's the unmarried and the widows. Then it's going to be those Christians are married to each other, and then it's going to be a believer who's married to an unbeliever. And that really raises the question again of how does the principle of stay as you are apply to each of these circumstances? Well, how it would apply to these people that are not married is don't seek to get married. And that's really the main thing he's going to be talking about in verses 25 through 38. So why then does he deal with it here? Is it just a side note that he mentions here and he's going to come back to it later? Who is this instruction really being addressed to? And what's the nature of this exception that's made in verse 9? Well, again, verse 9 is often interpreted to mean, you know, if they do not exercise self-control, or if they can't control themselves, then they should go ahead and get married. But that's not, again, what the text says. It's not a matter of whether people can or cannot control themselves. It's a matter of whether they actually are or are not controlling themselves. And the important thing here is to recognize that what Paul is not saying is that marriage is the cure for a sexual appetite. That if you're committing fornication, the solution to that is get married. That's not what he's saying. What he's saying is if it is your desire to engage in a sexual relationship, there's only one proper place in which to do that, and that is within the boundaries that God has established in a marriage relationship. But that marriage relationship itself is not something that is all about my own selfish lust and desire. Paul makes that clear in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, that we acquire our vessel in holiness and honor, not in passion of lust like the Gentiles who do not know God. And so if you understand what the marriage relationship is, and again, Paul's saying that that is the boundaries under which that is going to be engaged in, but also under the conditions that God has placed upon marriage. Now, clearly there were people in Corinth who were not exercising self-control. And Paul says, well, what they're going to have to do is make a choice. Either start exercising self-control, or if they're going to engage in that, then they're going to have to, again, change the way they are living in order to bring it within the relationship of marriage. But I really want to focus on verse 8 here. And this first term that is used, the unmarried, a lot of people assume that means people that are not married. I mean, duh, what could be clearer? Who is an unmarried person but someone who's not married, right? Well, in fact, however, how the Greeks use this term, it means someone who has been demarried. That is, they've been married before, and they have now wound up being unmarried. And it's a term that was used for widowers. And what you see here is the same balance where Paul mentions the man and the woman. Here, the widower and the widow. The problem is the Greeks didn't have a special word for a widower. And that was because you didn't have widowers. What do you mean by that? Well, certainly there were men whose wives died. But it's just like Paul explains in 1 Timothy chapter 5. A widow indeed doesn't merely mean a woman who's lost her husband to death. It means someone who's been left destitute and cannot be cared for by her own self. The circumstances being what they are in that culture, that economy, they're left destitute unless they have children or somebody who's going to take care of them. That's a widow indeed. Well, men were not left in that situation because a man whose wife died could still work and provide for himself, and so he didn't face the same difficulties and problems that the widow did. And so they had a special word for widow because it described a very special circumstance for somebody. And then when they decided to talk about a man whose wife had died, they used the term the unmarried, the demarried fella. And that appears to be the way Paul's using it here. He's not addressing just anyone who's never been married yet. He's going to address those virgins in verses 25 through the end of the chapter. But here he's addressing himself to those who've been previously married. And here they're also now not married any longer because of death. And so what he's saying is, yeah, there are those of you who've been married and now you're widowed. And of course, you should remain as you are. That would be the same advice he would give to those who are single. And yet that, again, is not by way of command. It's simply a concession that they're able to get married if they want to. Paul will even recommend remarriage for some widows under some circumstances. So we know it's not improper or immoral for a widowed person to remarry. Well, we didn't get around to answering the question tonight, but we'll resume with this at a later time and hopefully tie all this together. And hopefully you'll remember all the groundwork that we've laid, and so I won't have to repeat myself. I know you're worried about that. Well, if we have to hit this second thing, are you going to repeat the whole lesson and just save 5 minutes off of what we've already spent? Well, take your songbook and turn to number 655. And we'll sing this as a song of invitation. You know, all throughout the Old Testament, God uses the marriage relationship to describe his relationship with his people. And it's not surprising that in the New Testament this is picked up as well to speak of Christ as the husband of his bride, the church. And so that's more of a collective picture, but each of us individually fit into that relationship of the love of God and the self-sacrifice that he shows to us and what is called for on our part. And so if we have any inkling at all about what is involved in a marriage relationship, that's the kind of commitment and the kind of ideal of selflessness and love that God is calling for in our individual lives as well. And that's ultimately what all this is about. There's a lot of detail about what ought to go on in a marriage relationship, and Paul is dealing with a lot of that because of the unfortunate circumstances in Corinth. But the basic issue is very simple. You've made a commitment, you live up to that commitment, you keep your promises, you live as God has called you to live. And that's true in all of our relationships, but perhaps nowhere more true than the commitment we've made with God and our relationship with him. So let's think about that as we sing the song of encouragement. And as always, if there's some way we can be of a help to you even tonight, let us know while we stand and sing the song.